When it comes to Facebook and social media, these platforms are free to users. But could it be that we are the product being sold to companies and advertisers? We'll talk with experts in social media, privacy, and big data to answer your questions. What do you want to know? Give us a call at 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. Also, what's Illinois' role in the Dakota Access Pipeline?
We have millions of gallons running through the state, and we have four refineries. So we are a huge hub for crude and refined oil in general.
That's reporter Monica Ng speaking on WBEZ. We talk with her to learn more. Plus,
set a goal and then go for it, you know. Don't back up. Anything's possible.
That's 86-year-old Dean Troutman of Illinois, who has walked hundreds of miles to raise money for charity. We'll talk with him and people at Princeville High School who want to take it to the next level. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Every time you post something on Facebook or react to something you see in your news feed, it tells Facebook something about you. What does Facebook do with that information, and why does it matter? There's a new tool you can use to confuse Facebook about your true feelings. We'll learn more about that in just a minute. But if you have a question about Facebook, privacy, and big data, and would like to join our conversation today, our phone number is 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. I'm joined in studio now by Ben Grosser. He's a professor in the School of Art and Design at the University of Illinois, and also an affiliate at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. I'm also joined on the line from California by Sarus Farivar, Senior Business Editor at Ars Technica. Ben, Sarus, welcome to the 21st. Thanks both of you for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Ben, we'll start with you. Yeah, absolutely. Ben, we'll start with you. What made you decide to create the Go Rando extension, and what does it do?
So I'm, as an artist, my focus is on software, and specifically looking at the cultural, social, and political effects of software. And so I'm often looking at the software systems that we use in everyday life, wondering how, what we do with them, how they affect us, how they change what we do. And Facebook has long been an interest of mine as an artist. I have other works that involve Facebook as well. And so Go Rando, the work that you mentioned, this is a piece that tries to obfuscate how you feel on Facebook. What it does is it just intercepts every click on the like button. If you install it, it's a browser extension. And if you click like, it randomly selects one of the six reactions for you. So you might click like, and then you get angry, or maybe you get love, or maybe you get haha, or maybe you get like. Mm-hmm. But over time, you are giving the big data picture of Facebook, or inside Facebook, a kind of a confused understanding of how you feel about which kinds of content in the system.
And then what's the result of that? How does that impact then what you might see in the future on Facebook?
Right. So a lot of, everything that you see on Facebook is chosen by the Facebook newsfeed algorithm. It's not just simply a stream of what your friends post. And so whatever you like, however you like it, whatever you don't like, whatever you don't click, all of these things go into creating a very specific personalized selection of material for yourself. And so the idea is that by giving the system incongruent reactions that don't truly match what you feel or think, you will start to get a different picture. It's hard to predict exactly what that picture is, but you could imagine, based on what we do know about the newsfeed algorithm, that it is going to give you things that maybe don't fit your previous expectations. Some of these ideas of filter bubbles and things like that have been talked about a lot since the election, for example, where Facebook tries to give you more of what you want. And that has certain kinds of effects where you don't necessarily see alternative perspectives. So the idea is that if you install Go Rando and you have some of these random reactions, that you will start to see some different kinds of things in your newsfeed.
Sure. Now, of course, it's not just Facebook that's getting this randomized reaction. Your friend might see that you're angry at their cat video for some unknown reason. That could maybe create a little confusion among your friends.
It definitely could. The software doesn't preclude you from specifically selecting a reaction if you want to. And so if you click like and it selects angry, but that was on your friends, you know, happy, congratulatory, hey, I got a new job post. Or you can imagine all kinds of situations where it might not be so good. So you can select a specific one. I think part of what happens, though, and what I recommend to users is that they go rando first and ask questions later. The idea being that just click like, let it select whatever it selects, but that puts you in this position of having to step back and see what it selected for you. And then you can think, well, is that something, is that a reaction I can live with? Is it okay that I said ha-ha on this post? And so in a strange way, given how compulsive some of our like behavior is, letting random reactions be what happens for you, it almost makes you more mindful of what you're clicking in the first place.
Yeah, very interesting. Sarus, let's bring you into this conversation as well. I'm wondering if you could just give us a little broader picture on exactly what Facebook does with all this information it gathers about us from the likes and everything else.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, what was just said a moment ago is pretty spot on. I think that, you know, Facebook is a company that's designed to make money. You know, there's an old saying in this business that if the, you know, product is free, you're not the customer, you are the product. And that's sort of how I think we should think of ourselves, everybody who uses Facebook, Google, any of these kinds of services. You know, these companies are designed to run sophisticated algorithms based on our behavior and sell ads against that online behavior. So their effect, you know, making money off of our data that we share with Facebook in the way of, you know, clicking like or clicking angry or clicking on an ad or sharing news or doing anything that we do on Facebook. That's exactly how Facebook is designed to make money.
And Ben, I'm curious, you're just looking back, there was news a few years ago that Facebook was really kind of tinkering with their newsfeed, with their algorithm to kind of adjust what people were seeing in an effort to kind of see how they could maybe provoke different reactions. Was your work on this extension maybe, was it all based on that news from a couple years ago?
It wasn't all based, but it's certainly been a component of my thinking. I mean, to just flesh that out a little bit, it came out a couple years ago or whenever it was that Facebook was conducting experiments on its user base, trying to influence their emotions and then test to see how they were influenced. And they eventually came out and disclosed this and wrote a paper about it, but they didn't really have any sense that this was something that anyone should worry about. This is just, hey, this is covered in the terms of service, so we get to do this. And you know, so clearly they're interested in how we feel. And a lot of people are interested in how we feel. I think if we think about the recent presidential election in the United States, if we think about the Brexit election in the UK, there's been lots of effort and discussion of how can, for example, political movements utilize this data to understand who we are, what our hopes and fears are, and to target messages. I mean, ads are one kind of message, but you can think about ads as being a lot more broad in terms of political messaging and this kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, and of course that experiment was done in 2012, and the New York Times did some reporting on that in 2014. We'll send out that story in our Twitter feed here, and also link to it on our website here in just a bit as well. Sarus, I'm curious, why does all of this matter? Some people might say that they're glad Facebook knows what they like, so they can get better at putting more stuff that they like into their news feed, more cat videos, or whatever people like. Why does this matter?
Well, I think it matters because I would surmise that most people don't understand, you know, what Facebook's business model, and again, lots of other companies like Facebook, what their business model is, you know, Google and many others. It's not to say that it's inherently bad, but I think people should, you know, offer informed consent, and people should fully understand what it is that they're signing up for when they're using these services. You know, if you want to use a way to thwart Google's algorithms, you know, you're well within your rights to do that. But I think the broader point is that, you know, most people don't really understand how it is that their data is being used, and maybe people are okay with that. You know, I think that, you know, if you want to use Facebook, I use Facebook, lots of other people do too, that's totally okay. But I think anybody who uses Facebook should just be fully aware of what it is that Facebook is doing with your activities, and that when you click like or you click angry face or whatever the other emojis are, you know, you're communicating something to Facebook. You're not just, you know, telling your friend who lives across the country.
If you'd like to join in on this conversation, feel free to give us a call at 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. And we asked our Facebook, or our Twitter followers, excuse me, what do you not want Facebook to know about you? We got a few responses, including a tweet from Rogue, a bit tongue-in-cheek, that said, quote, "I did not actually major in knowledge of good and evil at Garden City Community College, Garden City, Kansas." You know, that's one way I think people try to trick Facebook. They put some false information in there about themselves. Is that just another way to kind of disrupt what Facebook is trying to do, Ben?
Yeah, I think that's a small moment of resistance to just simply give false information. I mean, one of the important aspects of Facebook is their ideology of true identity, the fact that they have in their terms of service that you have to represent yourself accurately. You can't just create a handle, you know, hide who your identity really is. And they have reporting mechanisms for reporting users who are violating this. I think a lot of people probably have somebody in their friend circle who is utilizing that kind of obfuscatory mechanism.
Sure. And I'm curious, Ben, what are you hearing from people who are using your extension? Do they see this as like a technical solution to this problem of Facebook collecting all this data, or is it just kind of a little individual protest?
I mean, I think people see it as what in some ways, kind of in the different lights that I would hope. Some of them see it as a personal tool to mix up their own data and really think about it just from a personal perspective. Other people think about it more collectively, and it gets them thinking about, okay, you know, where is this data going? Who gets access to it? Who does it benefit? Who does it make most vulnerable? These are the kinds of questions that I'm most interested in. I certainly have heard some users and people who are, you know, writing about this kind of material thinking about it within that context.
Yeah, and you mentioned, Ben, that you kind of see this as a way to kind of mix up what you're seeing in your own feed. Since you started doing this, what differences have you really seen in what's coming through your news feed in Facebook?
Well, here's what's interesting is that, and I am using it continuously and have been for the last month or so, it is still hard to ascertain, and that is because what the newsfeed algorithm does is so opaque. And so I can make presumptions about what I'm seeing. I've clicked angry on this, and now I'm seeing less of it. But honestly, it's hard to do that from without trying to be formally analyzing exactly what's coming over my feed. And I would surmise that it probably is going to take a little longer use to really have a significant effect, because there's my whole history of everything I've liked already built up in the system, and I can't go backwards and undo all of that activity.
Sure. And Sarusa, I'll ask you, other than the extension that we're talking about here with Ben today, what are some methods that you might suggest if people kind of want to get out of maybe a bubble they've created for themselves on Facebook, if they want to try and broaden their horizons and get some other things in their feed? What are some good ways to do that?
Well, I think, if you want to get other news sources, I think the tactic sort of applies equally whether you're on Facebook or whether you're just reading, kind of traditional print media or listening to things on the radio. I would say flip around, on your proverbial dial. That is to say, kind of look and see what other kinds of things, follow a few links, see where the rabbit hole goes. And, that means, taking an extra few minutes to try to break out of your normal kind of news and media diet, just in the same way that you might flip your radio dial or flip your TV channels or go to different websites that you would go to. I think in the same way, you can kind of click around further into, friends of friends of friends of friends on Facebook and see where that leads you.
Sure. And I guess I'll ask you this as well, Sarus. All these things that we're discussing here in this segment today, do you think people are really thinking about most of this stuff while they're online, while they're on Facebook?
I think most people don't generally think about privacy largely, online, whether they're on Facebook or on anything else. I mean, there's a lot of data that gets left around, sort of digital footprints, if you will, that get left online wherever we go and the tools that we use, that say a lot about us, And I would imagine for a lot of people, they probably don't mind, people like Facebook. Nobody, it wouldn't be as popular if people didn't like it. So it obviously provides some value, but I would just say, my only kind of caveat to people is just, again, be aware of what you're doing, be aware of the kind of data that you're communicating to Facebook and to others.
And Ben, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Cyrus is right on. I just wanted to add that, you know, it's important to remember that the data that you give to Facebook, let's say you're completely happy with Facebook doing anything they want with the data you give them to give you a better experience on Facebook, the data goes well beyond Facebook, and that's something important to remember. It gets collected by companies using it for ads and targeting, as I mentioned, in kind of political spheres. It gets sucked up by the National Security Agency and governments used to profile and try and understand who we are. So even if you are happy with it being on Facebook, just remember that it goes elsewhere, too.
All right, very good. We're talking about Facebook and big data in this segment on the 21st. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, you can give us a call at 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show as well. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation about Facebook privacy and big data. We're speaking with Ben Grosser, professor in the School of Art and Design at the University of Illinois, also by Cyrus Farivar, senior business editor at Ars Technica. 800-222-9455 or tweet us at 21st Show. Stay tuned. More coming up in just a moment. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about Facebook and social media, pulling back the curtain on all the information that these digital platforms gather about us on a daily basis and what that means. We're talking with Cyrus Farivar, senior business editor at Ars Technica, and Ben Grosser, the assistant professor in the School of Art and Design at the University of Illinois. And, you know, Ben, it can be a little tiring to expose yourself to ideas that conflict with your own. A lot of times it's easier just to kind of, you know, read what you like and see what you like. Why does it matter that you see things that you might not want to see?
That's a great question. I mean, certainly as humans, we love to just surround ourselves with whatever makes us most comfortable, right? We figure out who our friends are. We hang out with them. We don't hang out with the people we don't like. I get it. At the same time, I think the stakes are pretty clear in the wake of the U.S. election, just as one example, where a lot of people thought they knew what was going to happen. So people who were, say, voting for Hillary or looked at their news feed on Facebook and presumed they knew what was going to happen in the world. In other words, Facebook was giving them a picture of what the world looked like. It just turned out that isn't the picture. That picture wasn't accurate. And part of that is because Facebook is trying to give you exactly what you want and none of what you don't want. I mean, they want to keep you engaged. That's their mission. It's not a mission to inform us. It's a mission to keep us clicking and producing content for them. So in this way, I think, you know, that's just in terms of wanting to have an accurate picture of what the world actually looks like is one reason. You know, of course, there are other reasons to just broaden one's perspectives. I think, it didn't used to be that you wouldn't run into opinions you didn't like. That's a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean, even, you know, back in the newspaper days, you open up the newspaper and the likelihood that the newspaper is completely attuned to your point of view is very unlikely. So getting alternative perspectives is one of the ways that we can challenge how we feel, what we think, and reformulate new ideas.
Sure. And Cyrus, do you think the average person is aware of this, you know, that Facebook is not an accurate depiction of the world?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I would. It seems to me that you know, most people may not think about the differences in the way that I think many journalists might, or kind of savvy media consumers might think of the way in which we consume news. As was just said, you know, is very different. You know, you pick up any newspaper in any town in America, and the people that work at that newspaper, you know, have decided, you know, these are the most important things that you need to know. These are the factual things that you need to know that are happening in your community or in the country. You know, Facebook isn't that. Facebook is not designed to be a news platform. It is a social media network. So as you say, if all you want to see is cat videos, you'll only just see cat videos. And that's okay, you know. But if you're using Facebook as a means to get your news and find out what's happening, then yeah, I think that you need to be very conscious of, you know, what's there. You know, as the old saying goes, garbage in, garbage out.
One final question before we wrap up this conversation. I'll start with you, Cyrus. Does knowing all of this information about social media and big data, does it affect the way that you personally use Facebook and other platforms online, and how?
Well, I think that, you know, as I've grown older and as I've become more aware of how these, sites and services are used and how they work, I certainly have become more conscious as to what I put out there. You know, Facebook has, for example, you know, friends-only settings. It has private settings. But, you know, as we've learned, you know, just today, there was this big leak from the CIA to WikiLeaks, right? Nothing is private, right? Or it's very, very, very difficult to keep things private. So the sort of rule of thumb that I always have is that anything that is about me, you know, whether it has a private setting or not, I have to be sort of okay with the fact that it can be publicized or can be shared beyond the circle that I, you know, may not originally want it to be. So if I really want to keep something private, I just don't put it online.
Very good. And Ben, how about you?
I'm probably not as careful as I should be. I agree, you know, if you write anything online anywhere, you should presume it could show up on the front page of the newspaper at some point in your life. But I am conscious of it. But I also dive in pretty deep. I want to understand how it feels to use these systems and the way they're intended. And I think that means that occasionally I make myself a little more vulnerable than I would like. Maybe I put things out there that are more public, partially so that I can see and kind of track what are the effects of the system. You know, where are things going? How might it be changing my experience and thus possibly the experience of others too?
Very good. A very interesting conversation. We're certainly hoping it will get people's attention. And who knows, maybe we'll get lots of likes when we post it on our Facebook page later this afternoon. Or if there are users who have installed Ben's Go Rando Chrome extension, maybe there will be some love and anger reactions as well. We'll try not to take any of that personally. Ben Grosser, assistant professor in the School of Art and Design at the University of Illinois, also an affiliate at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. Ben, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Cyrus Farivar, senior business editor at Ars Technica. Cyrus, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
The Dakota Access Pipeline is well known as the crude oil pipeline that originates in North Dakota and ends more than 1,000 miles later right here in Illinois. What many people may not know about is the key role that Illinois plays in the pipeline. Why was Illinois chosen as the end of the route, and what's the status of the pipeline's construction here in our state? WBEZ reporter Monica Ng set out to answer all these questions in a story she recently did for Curious City, and she joins us now on the line from Chicago to fill us in on what she learned. Monica, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
I didn't know, and I wonder if many people in Illinois were aware of how Illinois is a huge oil transportation hub. How do we compare in that regard to other states?
Well, we're the number one for capacity in oil refining in the Midwest, and we're number four nationwide. We have a huge, huge storage facility in Patoka, Illinois, in southern Illinois, and we have just a ton of pipelines running through the state.
And I understand from your reporting on this that Illinois was once a big oil drilling state, so we certainly have a lot of the infrastructure for storing and distributing crude oil. You know, the oil that eventually comes to Illinois from North Dakota, where does that go?
Well, some of it will be transported around the Midwest to nearby refineries, but a lot of it is also going to hook up to an existing Energy Transfer Partners pipeline that's going to take it down to Texas, down to the Gulf for refineries there, and even for some export.
Okay, of course, the Dakota Access Pipeline is not yet complete, but the portions in Illinois are done. When were those built?
Those were built largely last year. The Illinois portion has been done since November. A lot of us didn't know about it, but it had its approval process the year before, and then it was about 6 months of construction.
And why didn't we hear very much about that construction process?
Well, unless you're a kind of a policy wonk person who's hooked into Illinois Commerce Commission hearings, you probably wouldn't have heard about it. And those who actually attend those hearings and who are called interveners or people with stake in the hearings, they're usually big trade groups, industry groups, political groups, people with lots of lawyers and lots of time to fill out forms to get a stake in the process. It's really not that well known by citizens. They can, of course, submit public comment on our state public comment sites, but that's just kind of a tiny part of it.
Could you walk us through this process a little bit? What agencies were involved in approving the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline here in Illinois?
Sure. Well, you had the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. They took a look to see how wildlife might be affected. And it turns out Illinois chorus frogs and fritillary butterflies are in that path, and both are threatened species. Then the Army Corps of Engineers took a look at very specific waterways that were under their jurisdiction to see how they might be affected, and the Historic Preservation Agency took a look to see if, let's say, Lincoln's Home or some Native American burial grounds were affected. But the big one was the Illinois Commerce Commission, and Energy Transfer Partners had to say to them, look, we want permission to build, and we want eminent domain authority to take the land if we can't get the landowners to let us build on their land. And then they had to go through a series of hearings to see if they could prove that they, A, deserved to be able to build, and B, deserved to be able to take the land if the owners weren't willing to let them do it voluntarily.
What kind of opposition was there to the project here in Illinois?
Well, most of the people who applied for standing were in support of the pipeline. Some of them were with manufacturers that built pipeline. Others were part of trade unions that had construction workers who would be employed by it. And they all said, hey, that's terrific. The Farm Bureau, the Illinois Farm Bureau, did present some opposition. They said, hey, look, isn't this being done in kind of a cart before the horse way? I mean, shouldn't ETP be asking for permission to build, then go to the landowners and say, now that we've got permission, can we use your land? And then if they can't get permission to use the land, then they should be applying for eminent domain authority. But they were applying for all of it at the same time. And so they pushed back. They were unsuccessful, but Illinois Farm Bureau certainly pushed back. And there was one citizen who was part of it. I don't know if you want to get into that part of it now. But, so it's very, very unusual to have citizens involved in these hearings. The most you'll see are citizens who own land in the path of the pipeline who get together and get a lawyer, and then the lawyer represents them there. But there was a woman, her name is Tabitha Tripp, and she belongs to an anti-fracking group in southern Illinois. She does not live in the path of the pipeline, but she brought a MoveOn.org petition to one of the hearings in Springfield and said, you know, here are 800 signatures of people who believe that you should not be granting ETP eminent domain. Eminent domain should be for the public good, not for private profits and interests. And while she was there, she talked to the administrative law judge. Those are the people who oversee the hearings for approval. And her name was Janice Von Quaylen. And she said, Judge Von Quaylen, how could I get a seat at the table with all these big boys? How could just a regular citizen who breathes air and uses water, how can we get our say in this? So she says that the administrative law judge took her to the clerk's office and says, you see all that paperwork, you got to fill out an affidavit, notarized forms, you have to register with an e-filing process, and you have to write a legal brief explaining why you deserve a stake in this. Believe it or not, Tabitha Tripp said, okay, I'll fill all this out. And then when she turned it in, she was shocked to find out she had been granted standing. She did her best to research all the issues, to learn how to write legal briefs, to examine and investigate the finances of the companies involved in this. And she submitted a lot to these hearings, to the point, I mean, you could have thought, well, she was just like this nobody non-lawyer from downstate who didn't make a difference. But she presented some financial documents questioning ETP's ability to pay for oil spills in the event that there was one. And that bothered them so much that ETP requested that all of her testimony be stricken and that she be removed from the list of people withstanding. So she wasn't kicked out, despite ETP saying she should, you know, why is she here? Get her out of here. She wasn't kicked out, but as we all know, it's been built, so she wasn't successful in stopping them, but it did create this, what many people feel is an incredible precedent of citizen involvement in these pipeline hearings.
Mm-hmm.
And now folks who are interested in pipelines, who want to get in on the front end of this, have taken her story as this inspirational story saying, holy cow, there's precedent for a citizen to get in on these hearings and to at least have her voice heard. So what they've done is they have carefully written down every step she took, the affidavit, the filing for e-filings, the brief explaining why she deserved standing, and the notarized documents. And their goal is to register 1,000 Illinois citizens for what they believe is an upcoming new pipeline that's going to run through Illinois.
Interesting. What's on the horizon for future pipeline construction projects here in the state, Monica?
Well, that's the one that they've got their eye on. Enbridge has what's called Line 61 that runs down from Wisconsin through the northern part of Illinois, and the activists have reason to believe that a twin is going in, and they want to be there at those ICC hearings, and they want to have their voice heard. They said, we'd always done this on the back end after we'd heard it had been approved, but we really want to try to get on the front end.
Very interesting. Monica Eng, reporter with WBEZ. We'll link to her story for WBEZ's Curious City about this project. But Monica, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Up next, Dean Trautman has walked hundreds of miles to raise money for area causes. This year, the 86-year-old hopes to do something even bigger. Dean talked with Nyla Boodoo yesterday, and we'll bring you that conversation in just a moment. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo, and this is The 21st. Stay tuned.
Tuning into The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. In 2015, Dean Trautman walked for 700 miles around Illinois and raised $70,000 to build a park in honor of his late wife. Last year, he walked 600 miles and delivered a check to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis. This year, the 86-year-old is trying to take it to the next level. He's partnered with Princeville High School to try to raise $200,000 for St. Jude's. The communications class at Princeville is coordinating fundraising events and reaching out to local media, like the Peoria Journal Star, which wrote about Dean Troutman. Dean Troutman's joining us now on the line from Princeville, along with Ann Krolecki. She teaches mass communications at Princeville High School. We're also joined by Emily Green, a sophomore at Princeville, which is about half an hour north of Peoria. Hey, guys. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dean, let's start with you. What in 2015 made you decide, I'm going to start walking hundreds of miles to raise money?
In 2015?
Yes.
That's when I raised the money for the park. We spent about 3 years building that park, and I ran out of money. And we still didn't have any playground equipment for the little kids. We had something for every other age, for up to my age, but nothing for the little kids. So I just suggested, what do you think if I got some sponsors and got pledges on the road? I said, do you think we could raise enough money to at least get some playground equipment? And yeah, we'll try it. And we had our sights set on, we'd already looked at the equipment, we had our sights set on $70,000 worth of playground equipment. So that's the reason I took off on this walk. And by the time I got home, they had ordered the equipment. We only raised just a few hundred dollars less than what we needed, but we had a little bit of money, so we were able to get the whole works.
And why did you, is walking something you've done your entire life?
Well, I've been active. I never did anything like that. That was taking off on 700 miles. That was the first time I'd ever attempted anything like that. But I've always been outdoors and active and reasonably good health. So I thought, it's the only way I could see to raise the money for the playground equipment. And as you can see, it worked.
And what is it like to walk for hundreds of miles?
Well, it's real enjoyable. When your legs don't, you don't have any pain, it is enjoyable. You meet some of the nicest people on the road, and you get to see everything up close firsthand and it's the people you meet that really makes it enjoyable.
Who have you met? I wonder when you think about it, who kind of stands out in your mind as some of the folks that you've met when you've been walking?
Well, there was one man in Taylorville. He was a firefighter. Their name was Robert Dunn and his wife. They were just exceptionally good. That's the one that really stands out. But there were so many, I hate to even name him because there were so many. And I hate to mention names and leave somebody out.
Yeah. And Dean, how many children and grandchildren do you have?
I got 4 children. I 10 or 11 grandchildren and 10 or 11 great-grandchildren.
Oh, no.
And 5 great-great.
Wow. So what do they all think about you walking?
Well, right at first, my children weren't too happy about it, the first year, but they agreed to it. And then again, the same thing last year. And it happened again this year. But they went along with me. They said, you know what you can do? You're old enough to know what you're doing, so go ahead.
And how did you, and how did you first learn about Dean and his walking?
I'm fairly new to the Princeville area. My husband and I moved back to Illinois about 2 years ago. And so just through, the media, I had heard the name Troutman. But then I really didn't know very much about Dean until he kind of showed up at my classroom door with another employee, Kelly Jenkins, who has helped him coordinate the past 2 years. And they said, we'd really like for students to get the opportunity to work with Dean and to plan a huge fundraiser like this. And of course, we jumped at the chance to do it because that's what life is, is the planning and making a difference. And so the reason I was able to get involved in it is because Dean saw a need for our students to do something bigger than themselves and bigger than their community. So I was really just sort of lucky.
Emily, how about you? You're a sophomore now. So when Mr. Troutman first started walking, were you a freshman? Or you weren't even in high school. It would have been the year before you started.
I was back in junior high.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I remember, like, the first, when he first set out going to, like, the Troutman's Park before it had, was even completely finished, and walking with him down the street on his departure from town. And so it's pretty cool to, like, now, like, this year I was actually able to be involved in that.
Yeah, Emily, so what's your involvement? What are you doing right now?
So we were pretty much, like, finding towns and that he was going to pass through and finding all their school information about the towns, because he was going to stop in those towns and speak with schools and encourage students to donate. And we also contacted sponsors. There's a lot of, like, the information behind the scenes that you have to have to for the whole thing to go through.
Yeah, so that's sophomore Emily Green. We're also speaking with Ann Krolecki, a teacher at Princeville High School, and they're talking about all the work that goes into what is called Troutman's Trek. Dean, I know the plan this year originally was for you to walk from Texas to Illinois. That's changed a little bit now?
Yes. It's like I said before I left each time. There's no guarantees. You know, these old knees and hips have got a lot of miles on them. And if they play out, or I break a leg or sprain an ankle or any reason I can't walk, there's no going on. And it finally happened this year. About, I think I got 51 miles before my right knee started giving me lots of trouble.
Oh.
And then I started walking with my foot pointed out instead of ahead, put a knee brace on, hoping that I could continue. But when I did that, the twisting of that foot outwards, it twisted my hip joint or something, because after about 5 or 6, 7 miles further, my hip was giving me so much pain I couldn't stand it. So after about 3 days, I said, well, there's no use fighting it. I'm just too old, too crippled. I'm going home.
So. Dear, well, that sounds painful no matter what age you are. What's the plan now? Are you all, what's the plan now for everybody? You're still trying to raise money?
Yes. Ms. Krolecki probably can tell you more about that than I can.
Okay.
I'm really involved in that part of it.
You know, behind all of this is Dean's mission, right? And Dean's passion. Hearing him talk about what he sees the purpose of life, it changes you. From the moment that you hear him talk, and he says, he has said before, you know, what else can you do than help other people, than help these kids at St. Jude? And so when he said that he wasn't able to walk anymore, you know, we kind of thought, well, what, you know, just like him, what else can we do? Now what we think we'd like to do is have mystery Skype dates with schools across the country and across the world, where we spend a little time trying to give each other clues and doing some critical thinking to figure out where each classroom is located. And then once we're done with that mystery Skype, we'd like to explain a little bit about Princeville, Illinois, what happens in our town, what kind of people live in our town, people like Dean who go out of their way and who are so selfless, and then encourage them to do some walking in their own schools and raise money for St. Jude towards Dean's fundraising website. So we're hoping basically to get other schools to walk the miles that Dean couldn't walk, effectively completing the trek for him.
So it's sort of like this, I'm going to date myself here, kind of like a where in the world is Carmen Sandiego, but for modern times via Skype. Is that what it sounds like you guys are hoping to do, Anne?
Yes.
Okay. How many miles do you need to cover?
Well, if you walked about 50, then we still have 1,150 to go.
Dean, I understand there was a pep rally for you at the school. Now that you're back, what's it like to work with all of these teenagers who sound pretty enthusiastic, I bet, to be hanging out with you?
Well, it's wonderful. You know, it's been 70 years since I was their age, you know, and I just love to work with those kids, and they give me a lot of encouragement, and I hope they can come out of it with, you know, something. There's nobody I like to work with more than children, and Well, there is no reason to build a park, you know, originally. And it's still the same thing on the St. Jude walks. It's the kids' account.
And I should ask, I hope you're all recovered from the 51 miles you did walk. How are you feeling now?
My leg is pretty good. I could probably go out and walk 4 or 5 miles, you know, pain-free. But I got to walk more than that, you know, to do a trek like that. I've got to cover 18 or 20 miles a day, and it just will not cooperate for that, you know, amount of walking. But right now it feels good.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. And what's next for you guys? So it sounds like now there's been a change of plans. You need to find schools to help walk the 1,150 miles or so. How do you want people to get involved?
So the first thing that I think we'll probably do is we are so fortunate and blessed to be living in a time where information can get out quickly. We put out on social media last week that an announcement would be coming, and sometime this week we're going to have a Facebook Live session on the Troutman's Trek Facebook page where we sort of explain the new plan and how schools can get involved in it. And we're just going to start putting information out on all kinds of different school and teacher websites where there are a lot of teacher traffic on those sites. And we're just hoping that schools will start out by getting volunteers who want to sign up to do something like this. And then we'll continue doing what we had been doing in the past, which was creating huge spreadsheets of towns and school names and administrator email addresses. And we just start off by emailing them and kind of letting them know what we're all about. And then we follow it up with a packet in the mail that gives them all the information that they need and also gives them just like a quick kit to start their fundraiser. So the kids have been behind all of that. They've created every single written communication that's gone out. They've created the flyers. They've created the Troutman's Trek website at troutmanstrek.com. They've been in charge of posting on social media to different news outlets. I mean, they're doing a lot of different things in here, and they'll just continue doing all those things, but through this new lens.
Mr. Troutman, are you hopeful that we're going to reach the goal that you had originally set for yourself? Do you think you're going to get different schools across the country to walk that, and you're going to be able to raise that money for St. Jude's?
Well, I certainly hope so. As an example, I stopped in the first town I walked to, the first day I walked in Texas, Hollidsville High School. I stopped in there that evening and talked to the entire school, and they had already raised over $500 in that one school, and the teacher said that probably after I left, they would raise much more. So, you know, I thought, man, this is a good start, you know.
Yeah,
set
what kind
goal,
of...
Set a goal and then go for it, you know. Don't back up. Anything's possible. And that was the message I tried to...
Are those the kind of things you say to the students? What do you talk to them? When you have a chance to speak to the students, what do you say to them?
Well, that's mainly it, you know. Just set a goal and keep setting goals all through your life and achieve those if at all possible, you know. Don't turn back. Sometimes it's pretty hard, tough, but you try your best to achieve a goal once you set it. And it seems like that's what these high school age kids and even younger and older, that's what they need to do, you know, to be a success in life.
Well, thank you for joining us. That is 86-year-old Dean Troutman. I want to thank also Principal High School Teacher Ann Krolecki and also student Emily Green. Thanks all of you for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
And we'll have all the information. Speaking of social media, we'll tweet out all of this at our web. It'll be at our website. We'll tweet it all as well, how to get involved with Troutman's Trek. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
That was Nyla Boodoo in a conversation recorded yesterday. Nyla should be back with us tomorrow. We're produced by Hala Dalahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montecilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Brian Moline filling in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.